Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Another Space Boffins podcast with space and boffins. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. In space, no one can hear you scream. Or can they? A team from Cambridge University is setting out to prove it, or not, with a mobile phone and some volunteer screamers.
What we're going to be able to do is take pictures from another camera on board the satellite showing this person's video of them screaming, whilst you have a view of the Earth in the background while the satellite's in orbit.
We'll also be hearing from a space shuttle engineer, and we're joined live in the studio by Gareth Jones, TV presenter, podcaster, space fanatic, one-time mullet wearer and musician.
Something like that.
Columbia, Challenger, Discovery, Atlantis and Endeavour, not forgetting Enterprise. After 30 years and 135 missions, the world's most complicated machine made its final landing in July. And now the remaining space shuttles are being stripped down and prepared for museums. Well, one of the shuttle engineers, Matt Mellis, was in the UK recently. A ballistics researcher at NASA's Glenn Research Centre, he worked on the Columbia disaster investigation. I met up with Matt and we began by talking about what made the shuttle so special.
I remember the first time I saw it, I walked into the vehicle assembly building and somebody was going to take me in to see it. My heart raced a bit when I saw just a glimpse of the cargo bay. I could see it in there and I knew I was actually going to get to see it. And there was only me and this other person in there the 2 or 3 hours that we were in there, and I felt like I had the better part of 3 hours with some celebrity.
6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start.
The vehicle really is not an inanimate object. And you talk to the people that worked on it, and actually all of them had very intimate relationships with the vehicles. They typically were assigned to one of the 5 orbiters that flew. And all of the orbiters had personalities in terms of their quirks, their technical quirks, and how they behaved and how they performed. And people identified with these things as not inanimate objects, but actually beings, in a matter of speaking.
Columbia, Houston, you're go throttle up.
Roger, go throttle up.
As I got more and more involved with the shuttle program, I would see the vehicles oftentimes in the orbiter processing facilities, or the OPFs, as we used to call it. And it reminded me very much of the vehicle being a queen bee, and all of its drones and workers were servicing it, you know, making sure that it was getting whatever it needed, all the care and feeding it was needed. And these drones and workers, if you will, sort of reminded me of the Borg in Star Trek, because everybody was sort of ignoring the others around them and just working on the vehicle and focused on specifically what their job was. Those are my impressions from the vehicle. And those are always my impressions. Whenever I came back, that was really how I felt. They're the same observations I made every time.
Flight Dynamics reporting a nominal main engine cutoff and separation from the external tank.
Every single mission, we prevented a tragedy. Through unbelievably talented teams, we prevented tragedies from happening. So we prevented Columbia and we prevented Challenger over and over and over again. But in the business that you're in with space travel, it's so risky and so complicated that if you let your guard down just for a second, okay, and you don't stay at 100% each and every second, something could creep through. And in retrospect, of course, hindsight's always 20/20. In retrospect, our inadequacies to identify problems with the solid rocket booster joint seal, particularly low temperatures, was a problem. And very tragically, with Columbia, we had a foam separation that happened on STS-112 just before the loss of Columbia. It was a wake-up call from the vehicle, but it didn't quite wake us up enough to understand the gravity of the situation. So those were both examples of how not keeping ourselves at our absolute optimum sharpness, we enabled a small design flaw to sort of rear its ugly head and take a vehicle and take 7 crew members with it.
This is Mission Control, Houston. Flight controllers here in Mission Control have declared a contingency as a communications was lost with the Space Shuttle Columbia during its descent from orbit en route to a landing at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The last communications with Columbia occurred at about 8 a.m. Central Time as it was above the North Central Texas area at an altitude of approximately 200,000 feet. any debris that is located in the vicinity of the North Central Texas area that may be related to the shuttle contingency should be reported to local law enforcement, who will then report to NASA. It should be avoided. Debris could be potentially hazardous due to toxic substances that are used as propellants on the space shuttle.
You worked on helping to piece together the scenario, what happened to Columbia, and literally piece it together in a hangar. Did that then become apparent that there were lots of things he didn't quite understand about the way the shuttle was performing or failing to perform?
Yeah, that's a true story. And I was involved with hundreds of people in the accident investigation. My primary responsibility was to be assembled as part of a team at the NASA Glenn Research Center to conduct ballistic impact research to identify the impact characteristics of the foam that came off the vehicle and the thermal protection systems on the vehicle, how they would respond. We had to better characterize that. But there's a great quote written some 20, maybe even 30 years ago now. It was slightly after Challenger, called "The Engineer is Human," actually written by a civil engineer named Henry Petrosky. And he talks about the lessons that we learn from engineering tragedies. And the quote goes something like, "Major disasters and failures of structures are inevitably failures of design. Sometimes you have management or organizational failures. And the lessons that we learn from these investigations have done more to advance engineering knowledge than all the successful machines and structures in the world." And that's absolutely true.
That said, and all that information gained, was it too soon to retire the shuttle?
It was my personal opinion. What I wanted to see was sort of a measured approach to the development of long-term presence in low Earth orbit and beyond. And so what that would mean was not having a vehicle that was going to be around for 30 years, that we would build an orbiter or two, and then using a measured approach and lessons learned, continually try to simplify and make safer the vehicle and improve the vehicle at the same time, improve the payload, improve its capabilities and whatnot. And so in a perfect world, I would have liked to have a consistent policy to develop a new vehicle every decade, every 12 to 15 years, maybe at the most. And so from a certain perspective, I thought shuttle in its current form probably should have been retired 15, 18 years ago, and we should have moved on to a hybrid vehicle that had evolved out of shuttle. It wasn't the loss of shuttle that was deeply sad to me, you know, at the end of the program. It was the fact that we didn't have an evolutionary step into the next phase. We're moving in that direction, but, you know, slower than anybody wants. We would like to be out of the gates with a vehicle, right, rather than, you know, retiring the program. But with programs as complicated as shuttle, the missions are planned years in advance, and the cancellation was planned years in advance. And so I think that there was a certain expectation on behalf of the agency that we would have nearly an operational system that we could get up to station and start carrying on our new missions. And that just hasn't happened due to many, many factors.
Endeavour's Commander Mark Kelly now firing the thruster jets to position the orbiter for photography of the external tank.
We did see a nominal MECO. Ohms 1 is not required.
All the way back to Apollo, people looked to NASA for leadership and guidance. And so I want to see the agency lead and guide and continue to do so. I mean, we've done a great job so far. And so that has to be tied to a very, very significant mission that's going to continue to evoke that emotion that we talked about a little while ago. So, yes, I'm optimistic, but I want to get there really fast, you know, and we're in between right now. So I can't wait until we get the next mission going to when I can go back out into the schools and promote these great things that we do and look at the wonder in these kids' faces. It's really fantastic.
1 hour, 2 minutes, and 28 seconds from now, Endeavour headed for a touchdown on Kennedy Space Center Shuttle Landing Facility runway 15 from the north.
It was a masterpiece. It was an absolutely marvelous achievement. It made people cry when it took off. You know, that was how I define the quality of the vehicle, is that does it evoke emotion? If the vehicle doesn't evoke emotion, then we really need to go looking back into the drawing board and find something that is going to evoke emotion, because that's what rumbles in our spirit, you know, the spirit of exploration, and it's what makes people get so excited about it.
Nose gear touchdown. Having fired the imagination of a generation, a ship like no other, its place in history secured, The space shuttle pulls into port for the last time. Its voyage at an end.
Well, it makes me well up every time. I was talking to NASA engineer Matt Mellis, and the piece I didn't include, I looked back and reviewed a lot of material that put that together. In 2003, when the Columbia disaster was happening, there was this exchange between Mission Control Houston and Columbia, and you heard, you know, Houston, Columbia, Columbia, Houston, and then it got increasingly almost plaintive.
Yeah.
It was Columbia, Houston, Columbia, Houston, and there was just nothing coming back, just static coming back. That was the bit that really, and I didn't include it in that because it was really too disturbing.
I found exactly the same thing. I've used that very sample. I put together a sort of compilation of space songs, which if you are a space nut like you guys and me and lots of people listening to this, it's the sort of thing you do. You know, it'll start with Life on Mars. It'll have Saturn V by the Inspiral Carpets on there. And in between the tracks, I used NASA samples. And it finished with that Columbia, Houston. Columbia, Houston. It is too sad.
It is.
Goosebumps.
It's in the same way that you can't find, and actually I didn't
go
really
with
look
Throttle
for,
Up.
Yeah.
You can't find it.
No, and yeah. I think quite rightly,
yeah.
NASA have removed most of the Challenger stuff from their website apart from the tributes.
I was quite amazed listening to him. He actually sounded like an astronaut. Yeah. And I had to remind myself, hold on, this is the guy that does the nuts and bolts of stuff here. Even he sounds like sort of Buzz Lightyear.
They are.
Talking about the inspirational side of it and how he's going to work with kids and what have you. And that's very impressive.
I should say he's put together a fantastic video. It's called Ascent. Also, there's an iPad app that goes with it. And these are images he's used and video he's used from these high-speed engineering cameras. So you see the shuttle engine start up. And it
gimbaling.
Takes about 30 seconds. Exactly. Yeah. You could see the thrusters move backwards and forwards. So we'll put a link up to that on our Facebook page.
Unfortunately, for those of you who couldn't see him, I'm gimbling. Bit of movement there. Our studio guest presents science programmes, producers and stars in the spectacularly successful podcast, Gareth Jones on Speed.
Thank you.
And in a past life was a children's presenter formerly known as Gaz Top. More importantly for us, though, he's a lifelong space addict, which might explain why he's written an interactive CD-ROM called The Space Race.
I did.
Presented a number of space-related programmes for Channel 4 and the BBC.
I have.
And has been for a walk with Buzz Aldrin.
I have.
How did that happen?
I go around telling people that you should turn your hobbies into an occupation, and that's what I did. I turned my passion for space and science technology, as you guys did, into an occupation. And I made a programme for the BBC of the 25th anniversary of the first moon landing. Whilst doing that, I went to Kennedy to film for a week and arranged for Buzz Aldrin to be flown to the UK. And then I went for a walk with him on the roof of Television Centre. And I just asked him what it was like, that awful question, you know, what was it like on the moon? And what was occupying your mind while you were on the moon? And curiously, he came across like a broadcaster. His reply was, well, I was worried about tripping over the cable.
He does have that fantastic phrase that he came up with on the moon, magnificent desolation.
Yeah.
And I love that.
You've done this basic endurance astronaut training at space camp in Belgium.
Yeah.
What was that actually like? I assume it was like astronaut training light and they didn't give you the full centrifuge experience.
I did have a multi-access chair experience. Didn't do the centrifuge. I did some wet F stuff. You know, the wet facility where you go down into a huge swimming pool, or in this case, a tank, really. A very, very deep tank. And I assembled, what was it called? Ease and Access. There was a Meccano kit that they took into space on the shuttle in the very early days. To...
Are you sure that wasn't a satellite?
Ease and Access. I think it was like a Meccano kit. Seriously, it was a number of components which clicked together to create a kind of geodesic frame. So it was very lightweight, see if they could assemble in space. And I did some of that in this tank. They put me in a multi-access chair. And it was at that point I realised realised I probably wasn't going to be an astronaut, because it took me about an hour and a half to recover afterwards. The whole room just spun and spun. But 50% of the people who go into space suffer from space sickness. So
apart from Helen Sharman, I remember reading
she
that she didn't. And I just remember I was already jealous as hell, but to read that she wasn't even travel sick was just like...
I applied for that gig and I didn't get it.
How do you feel about the demise of the shuttle? Because it's interesting, isn't it? What's going on at the moment in space? Because you could either take it as the end of an era, isn't it sad, or we're on the cusp of a new and exciting, funky era in space.
Necessity is the mother of invention. Having lost what was rightly described by you as the most complicated vehicle ever, we're forced into a situation whereby we've got to do everything that that vehicle did in a number of other cheaper ways. It's very exciting that SpaceX are developing the Falcon stuff. And they're doing it cheaply and quickly, that faster, cheaper, quicker,
better. But it's the timing's out, isn't it? You were sort of, when you were listening to that interview, when they said about they should have done it 15 years earlier, you went, yes.
Absolutely.
And we were all completely...
Well, do you remember there were designs for something called Shuttle 2, probably 15 years ago? It's extraordinary that the shuttle did last as long as it did. It's one of those examples of high-tech engineering which was a glimpse of the future as it appeared in the past, as Concorde was. And you can put Concorde and Shuttle in the same bracket exactly. It was a moment where we did reach further than we ever had done before and consequently couldn't sustain that. It was just a bit too much. Yes, I am sad that the Shuttle's gone. However, I have to say it was always a compromised vehicle. And I blame Nixon. You know, what is it they say? Guns don't kill rappers. Rappers do. Rockets don't kill astronauts. Presidents do. Nixon's compromise to the budgeting of Shuttle, making it a less sophisticated vehicle, strapping on a couple of firecrackers, made it far more dangerous. Reagan's pressure to force the space transportation system to become a commercial, operational vehicle in a very short space of time is what compromised the safety of Mission 51L when we lost Challenger. If the shuttle had stuck to its original design, more like the Sanger space plane of two reusable vehicles, one on top of the other, both winged, it would have been more difficult to develop, more expensive to develop, but would still be here today, obviously.
And I think we forget that there was been a gap before, the end of Apollo, when after those Apollo Soyuz missions in the mid-70s, to the shuttle.
Was it 76 until 81, something like
81
that?
81 was the first shuttle, so it must be around that. Sorry, I have one final question.
Yeah.
Gilbert the Alien.
Yes!
I can't even remember what the... Get Fresh, wasn't it?
Yes, right. Yes, yeah. Yep.
Was it really an alien?
Yes, he was from the planet Drill, apparently, which is very boring. That's why it's called Drill.
And what happened to him?
He's alive and well and currently living in Leon C, supporting Tottenham Hotspurs, I believe.
Oh, lovely.
Seriously.
Oh, no, that's great.
Well, thank you very much, Gareth. And Gareth will be singing live for us in just a few minutes' time.
And we know from the Alien films that in space, no one can hear you scream. Well, a team of students took that tagline to heart when they entered a competition to design an app for an Android mobile, a phone that's going to fly on the world's first smartphone nano-satellite built by Surrey Satellite Technology Limited.
Well, one of the four winners is a team from Cambridge University's Space Flight Society. So I went there to meet team members Edward Cunningham, John Soman and Adam Gregg to find out more about their app. And as I soon discovered from Adam, they have a pretty good track record with interesting space-related projects.
We've been working with Android phones in near space by putting them up on high-altitude balloons. We've written some basic apps for them which take photos and video and then communicate back to us where the phone is using its onboard GPS. So, for instance, once the phone's landed, if it can get phone signal again, it can text us its location and we can drive out and pick the thing up. So we've been doing a lot of balloon work, and this seemed like a fairly interesting thing to play with because modern smartphones have so many sensors built in that it makes life really easy for us. We can write a simple app and it's got a GPS on it, it's got a camera built in.
So, Edward, how do you go about then testing your hypothesis? In space, no one can hear you scream. You've got a phone with you here. Talk me through what you're actually going to do.
We're going to be relying on members of the public to help us out in this regard. We're going to have a website that's going to be up and running in 2012 that'll be inviting people to upload videos of themselves onto YouTube screaming. And the idea is that we're going to then send up the winning videos. People will be voting on their favourite ones that they think are most worthy of being part of this experiment. They'll be loaded onto the phone. And then when it's launched into orbit, we can then play these videos on the phone. So we've got to remember that this phone has a speaker and a microphone. So when this video plays on the phone, there'll be the sound of the winning screams being played. And then we can record on the microphone, can we hear anything in space? Common sense science says sound shouldn't be able to travel, but that's something we hope that people will be able to maybe learn a bit more about the science behind it and get people interested in that. We've got a simple prototype of the app here that we're going to be having running. And what we've got here is a demo video that's going to be running, which is actually the start of a Thunderbird sequence. 4, 3, 2, 1. This is just showing the video. It's playing on the phone whilst being able to see the view from the camera in the background.
Ah, yes, little pictures of the hood there and Thunderbird 3 and Thunderbird 2 taking off.
What we're going to be able to do is take pictures from another camera on board the satellite showing this person's video of them screaming whilst you have a view of the Earth in the background while the satellite's in orbit. And at the same time, we're going to be recording a video and audio, which allows us to be able to see, can you hear anyone screaming, which is kind of fun.
You do realise, of course, that this could crash your server.
Yes, I know. I think we're going to have to be quite careful to design this thing so that when we have our opportunity for people to upload videos and for people to vote on videos, we're going to have to make sure that we're capable of handling, hopefully, a vast amount of submissions and votes.
Now, the Space Flight Society has done some quite amazing things with their phones. John, sum up just a few of the things that you've done, because you can see some of them on YouTube as well.
On one of the previous launches, we've taken several pictures of near space, so that's 30 kilometres, maybe even a bit higher. Last time we flew the phone, it also took several videos, which, as you said, are on YouTube and on our website. We've also done the usual things that we do with flight computers on high-altitude balloons, so position reporting, also measuring things like temperature and reporting that data back over radio links.
This isn't the first time, though, that you've been in the sort of playing with the big boys, the big league here. You've also done work with the European Space Agency before now.
Yeah, a couple of years ago and running on for 2 years, we did a project with the European Space Agency to test Mars lander parachutes, where we developed a high-altitude drop vehicle which could have the parachutes loaded onto it. Then it was carried up by a helium balloon to about 25 kilometres and released, at which point it accelerates up to Mach 0.8, then deploys these test parachutes with a whole load of sensors running on the test vehicle so we could record data about the parachute's performance, as well as high-speed video cameras to watch for parachutes deploy so we could check everything went okay. So it was a fairly major project and consumed a lot of our time and effort, kind of making sure the systems were fine, putting in lots of fail-safes and backup parachutes and so on.
So what for you then would be the main aim of this project? You've done, if anything, probably more complicated stuff before this one. This one, though, is an important one because it's actually the first time you've got something going on a satellite. What do you want to get out of it, Edward?
Well, I think as a society, certainly, of course, it's nice to have some of our work going to be running in orbit in real space. Naturally, we hope that we'll be able to make it in space by our own efforts one day, not too far away. I guess there's a important element of this, which is outreach and getting people interested in science and space technology. A few years ago, we'd launched some teddy bears into low space, essentially, for some school children.
And I hope the bears came back safely.
They did come back safely. I think so. We had some temperature probes inside. The school children were asked to see how warm they could keep them by building spacesuits out of tin foil and stuff like that.
So no bears were harmed in the making of that project?
I think the official line is no.
Well, I think it goes without saying that I'll be putting my scream forward, and our thanks to Edward Cunningham, John Soman and Adam Gregg. We'll put a link to their Space Flight Society on our Facebook page, where you'll find photos of those students as well. And we'll let you know as soon as they're accepting the screams. Gareth, are you going to put yourself forward?
Do they accept Welsh screams?
Oh, I would have thought that would be essential. In fact, I did ask them, I said, how are you going to judge the screams? Because you don't want every pitch the same, because that might affect, as anybody knows, from a deep bass, that would travel the vibrations, maybe going through their phone. So maybe a very deep scream or a variable tone screen.
I will scream in a minor key, like a Welshman.
Well, because this podcast sees in the new year, we're going to end with a song. Gareth first released this single, Don't Get Me Wrong, in 1986 as a tribute to the American space program. Gareth's ready with his guitar. He's even brought along a backing singer, Anna Maria Borg. And this brings us rather neatly back to our starting point, Gareth. You recorded the original the day Challenger exploded.
I thought it was sad that an organisation which had gone from such a high, the first moon landing, to such a low, the death of seven wonderful people, that someone ought to point out that, you know, if you make an omelette, you break a few eggs. If you reach for the stars, you're going to lose a few people along the way. But, you know, don't give up. Don't get me wrong. I'm not criticising. This is how it is.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
They started something, something I didn't understand. 2 decades, a firebrand, it made the news worldwide, prime time. Don't get me wrong, and the way it goes, it seems to me that they set the standard at the lowest bid. Don't expect perfection when the finance section holds the ruling hand. See what they did. Turning Europe's turmoil into America's pride. Magnificent Seven, brave and handsome, made the news prime time worldwide. Don't get me wrong, and the way it goes, it seems to me that they set the standard at the lowest bid. Don't expect perfection when the finance section holds the ruling hand. See what they did.
And at this fiery, thunderous instant, the tireless efforts of thousands for over a decade and the dreams of millions throughout the centuries converge as the majestic Saturn V rocket catapulted man into history and mankind into the future. On July 16, 1969, at exactly 9:32 a.m., the heart of the whole world stopped momentarily as three American astronauts left the world probably never again be the same.
They started something, something I didn't understand. 2 decades, a firebrand, it made the news worldwide, prime time. Don't get me wrong, and the way it goes, it seems to me that they set the standard at the lowest bid. Don't expect perfection when the finance section holds the ruling hand. See what they did, and the way it goes, it seems to me that they set the standard at the lowest bid. Don't expect perfection when the finance section holds the ruling hand. See what they did.
Roger, how does it look? Eagle Houston, we ring in at your go for PDI, over. Roger, understand.
So much given by so few. Say what you like, do what you can do. In the darkest hour will hope survive. No surrender, keep that dream alive.
Over, to the right, level. Ready? Hour and a half. 30 seconds,
over. So much given by so few.
Say what you like, do what you can do. In the darkest hour will hope survive. No surrender, keep that dream alive.
We copy you down, Eagle. This is Tranquility Base. The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. We got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Hey,
Hey!
Yeah, oh, well, fantastic! Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very the applause is going to sound a little pathetic because only four of us in the studio and two of them are recording themselves.
Yeah. Our thanks there to Gareth Jones and Anna Marie Borg. And Anna, you sang on the original didn't you?
I did.
That's wonderful. Well,
he's still my friend.
Thank goodness for that.
The Space Boffins podcast is a Boffin Media production supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium Plus. And you'll know this if you've been following our Facebook page, a grant from the UK Space Agency.
Woo! And it means that we're secure here for at least a year, which gives us time to find more sponsors willing to help with production costs. So thanks to everyone who supported our first 6 months.
If you like the podcast, please spread the word. You can find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.